The thawab of it to all the deceased from our family, our community, our friends, the ulama, the shuhada, all of those who need of our du'as, and especially for the Iraqi forces who are working to mobilize Mosul for their victory. Let's also recite Surah Fatiha, please. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد والصلاة والسلام على أهل بيت الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما مولانا وسيدي صاحب العصر والزمان روحي وأرواح العالمين له الفداء وأجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد ولعنة دائمة على أعدائهم ومنكر فضائلهم من الآن إلى قيام يوم الدين ما بعد رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي For the hastening of the advent of our 12th Imam, one salawat upon Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. My dear brothers and sisters in Iman, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. As we have been going over these last 2 weeks of the month of Muharram, where we commemorate and we have commemorated the tragic sacrifice, the tragic martyrdom of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam and his family and friends. Obviously, this is an event which continues on, not only in the sense that it continues because we commemorate the tragedy of Karbala up until the time of Arba'een. And so for these 2 months, and even some communities even extend that past Arba'een to the 9th of Rabiul Awwal. Whatever the case may be, this commemoration of the supreme sacrifice of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him and his family, is obviously an event which we are far distanced from in terms of time. It was 1,377 years ago where this event transpired in a land obviously very far away from where we are today. And we gathered together, and believers all around the world, as we know, have gathered to mark this sacrifice of Imam Hussein. And we've obviously gone through many lectures, and we've heard many speakers speak about different issues of Karbala, analyzing what was happening before, during, and after the event. For these few nights that we have together, from now until the night of Arba'een, we have about maybe 4 or 5 sessions together, Thursday nights and a few other events in the middle. I want to take an opportunity to try and analyze to the best of our ability, given the time and other circumstances that we have in front of us, the mission and the message of Karbala. How or why is this an important event to commemorate? You know, we've been marking it traditionally, religiously for so many centuries. Is there a relevance in our day and age? Is it important as a question to pose to ourselves to continue to commemorate this event? Is there a certain way that the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, asked us to commemorate this event? Or is it all based on culture? Is there a religious aspect to the commemoration? Is it culture? Is it a fusion between the two? And maybe somewhere in our discussion we'll try to analyze what role do we play, or what role does our culture that we live in today, where can we take inspiration from our culture, which is we can call it a Canadian culture, a culture which is unique in its own ways. How can we take the message of Karbala, and just as other traditions, just as other countries have taken the message of Abu Abdullah, how can we formulate it and present it in a way that would be understandable to those who are foreign to our religion, to our cultures, to where many of us come from in different parts of the world? Inshallah, we want to try to analyze and dissect the message of Karbala in this way. And we want to start out tonight by looking briefly at what was going through the mind of Sayyidina Shuhada when he was proceeding from Medina to Mecca and eventually making his way towards Kufa. And as we know that he was stopped, he was not able to make it to Kufa, and that is why today Karbala is that land that we commemorate the event of Karbala on. But what was going through his mind, in his own words, not that we want to extrapolate or suppose what he was thinking, but to look at some of the statements of Abu Abdullah and those of the family and companions of what happened on that day of Ashura. Salu ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. One of the things that becomes clear when we want to study the movement of anybody, whether it be a political figure in our own day and age, whether it be a religious figure, whether it be even a businessman, for example, when we want to study what they're doing, we obviously want to look at what they say about themselves, right? When you want to look at a politician, for example, why they're running for prime minister or president, and we have ample opportunity with the election south of the border to analyze these sorts of things, we look at what a person says about themselves. What is their track record? What are they saying about their movement? Why are they doing what they want to do? And obviously, when you look at the speech and you hear what a person says and how they act and how other people perceive them to be, that shows us a lot about that individual and why they're doing what they want to do. If we look at, say, the shuhada in the same way, you know, because sometimes people try to paint a picture that the revolution of Karbala was about personalities. Sometimes you might hear this from outside of our community, and maybe even from within our community, some people may say this. They may purport to say that Imam Hussein was in a clash with an individual like the cursed Yazid, that it was a clash of personalities. It was one man against the other. And sometimes this becomes, you know, also further, it grows further into people looking at the movement of Karbala to be a humanitarian mission, a humanitarian movement, that he was trying to, you know, do good things in society. And, you know, that's why today people seem to use the name of Hussein for good motives, which is not a problem in and of itself. But we have to realize, when we trace the roots of Karbala back to why Sayyidul Shuhada did what he did, it wasn't just a feel-good movement to bring about social change, to bring about, you know, good actions within a society. Ultimately, when you look back at when he wrote to his half-brother, Muhammad al-Hanafiya, that will, he mentions clearly in that will why he's taking the stand that he takes. And he tells him, he says that, "I'm not making this revolt. I'm not standing up in opposition to Yazid for my own personal fame. It's not a personal conflict, you know, between Hussein, peace be upon him, and Yazid. It's not about him, as he says, wanting to create corruption or mischief or problems in the society." He tells it clear that it's not about him as an individual seeking to gain authority, but he says that my entire motive behind this revolution is to bring about a rectification, to bring about a change in the Muslim ummah, in the ummah of his grandfather. And you have to realize, obviously, we don't have the time to analyze every single aspect of his journey, but you'd have to wonder what happened to the community of Muslims in 50 years after the death of the Prophet, that a so-called governor, leader of the Muslim community, is ready to shed the blood of somebody who disagrees with him. And this was not a normal person. This was the grandson of Rasulullah that he was ready to shed the blood of. And so Hussein made it clear that there was a problem in the Muslim ummah at that time. Islam, as we know, is the perfect religion. If Muslims today around the world had followed Islam as a religion, we wouldn't have the problems that we see within our world today, within our communities today, within our families today. But because Muslims have diverted from the path of Islam, so Sayyidul Shuhada says that, "I'm taking this stand to bring about islah, this rectification in the nation of my grandfather." And he says, through this movement, "I want to establish the good, amr bil ma'ruf, and prevent and forbid evil, nahi anil munkar." And he shows us that this is not a new phenomenon. What he was doing, he was following, he says, in the footsteps of his grandfather, the Messenger of Allah, and his father, Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi salatu wassalam. So he made it clear that this was a religious movement. It wasn't a social ideology or a change in the social system. It was a religious responsibility that Sayyidul Shuhada had. And we have to appreciate that internally. We have to internally realize that Sayyid al-Shuhada was making a revolution based on Islam, based on the true mission, the true vision of Islam that his grandfather brought, that his brother was protecting, that this was a religious movement that he was leading. And it shows us that, you know, sometimes some Muslims have this ideology. Even today, some Muslims believe that if a government is placed above you, a Muslim government, even if they're corrupt, even if they're evil, even if they're the ultimate sinners, that you still have to obey them and submit to them. And they bring verses of the Quran to legitimize their authority. But Sayyid al-Shuhada shows us, the Master of the Martyrs shows us, that a government is not legitimate within Islam. An Islamic government in an Islamic society is not a legitimate government if it is breaking the rules of the religion. He then tells us that this was a tradition of his grandfather that he was following. From here, when Sayyid al-Shuhada makes this movement, he begins to gather the people around him, both in Medina and then when he makes it to Mecca. We realize when you analyze the sermons that he was delivering, that he was well aware of the outcome that they would face on the day of Ashura. Maybe the companions, maybe the families didn't know the day of the martyrdom, although that could also be debated. But they knew for a fact, by the words of Sayyid al-Shuhada, that they were not going to come out of this alive. There was no turning back. There would be no return back to Medina, at least for the men. The women, obviously, we know, and we'll talk about that as the nights progress, the women would make it back to Medina, as well as the fourth Imam, Imam Zain al-Abidin, and Imam al-Baqir, peace be upon both of them. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. But the men knew for a fact that there was no return back to Medina. Once they set up on that caravan, once they left Mecca after changing their intention from the Hajj to the Umrah, coming out of the Ihram and making their way towards Kufa, they knew that they wouldn't return. And Imam Hussein is clear. In one of his letters, or one of the speeches, he says the following. He says in one of them, he says that whoever of you is ready to give their souls, to give their life away, and they're ready to change their home, where they're living, from where they are now, to be in the company of Allah, he says, then you need to come with us, you need to join us. So he made it clear at that one level that this was a journey which was not a return journey. They would lose their lives in this event. And then when he approaches Karbala, he makes it even further clear. And he addresses, according to some narrations, this is in relation to Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad. In other traditions or other ways our scholars interpret this tradition, it could be related to Yazid and his entire family. But he says in the tradition, he says, Allah inna da'i ibn da'i kad rakaza bayna thnatain bayna silla wa dhilla wa hayhat minna dhilla. He says this illegitimate child, the illegitimate one, the son of the illegitimate one, has put me in this conundrum. He's put me in this position between two words, between two positions, bayna silla or dhilla. Silla basically meaning that either I am put to the sword or be dhilla, which is I have to live a life of being degraded, being in a life of humility, humiliation, of giving in to the cursed Yazid. And Hussein alayhi salam made it clear, he says, wa hayhat minna dhilla, that far be it from us, the Ahlul Bayt and our followers, to ever be in a point where we have to humiliate ourselves, where we have to lower ourselves in a negative way in front of the tyrant, in front of the enemies. So he made it clear that there was only one choice for him. It was either the sword or humiliation. He wasn't ready to take humiliation, so he opted for the sword. He realized that this would be his end, and his family, his companions, that they would lose their lives. But ultimately, he was teaching a lesson for generations to come, that when it comes to either standing your ground, when you have ground to stand on, when you have a firm basis as Muslims to stand upon, and to humiliate ourselves, to embarrass ourselves, he says that it's clear where we have to stand, and that even if we have to lose the most precious of things which we hold dear to us, then that is what we have to do in the face of holding on to the legacy of Sayyid al-Shuhada, Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam. And so they knew this. They knew that their days were numbered. They knew that they were not going to submit to Yazid, because Imam Hussein, in one of his other sermons, he described Yazid in vivid detail. And this is not even only from our point of view. You know, there are non-Shia historians and contemporary scholars in today's day and age, and we can give you references after the program if you want, who, when they described Yazid, how he was as an individual, everything evil that you could find that is prohibited in Islam was embodied in the character of Yazid. Alcohol was forbidden. He was seen to openly consume alcohol. Prayers, salat, had no meaning in the life of Yazid. You know, the way he treated women, the way he was a womanizer, it was clear from the statements of all Muslims of what status this man had, and things which I can't even mention on the minbar of how he was. But this shows us that his character was something so vile that Sayyid al-Shuhada and the companions and family could not allow this sort of an individual to take the reins of the Muslim community. And had he had been allowed to do that, we would have seen that Islam today would not be what we have today. Islam today would be completely annihilated. It would have been obliterated off of the map. Quran would have been something which people would have paid little respect to. Islam as a religion would not be where it is today, even though we have far way to go still. But basically, this movement of Sayyid al-Shuhada in every stage of the journey shows us that what he was doing was very calculated. It was very precise. Every step that he took from Medina to Mecca to Karbala was in line with the ethos of the religion of Islam, and exactly what Rasulullah and Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi wasalam brought to the society. And we know that, and we've gone already through the days and nights of Muharram till Ashura. And you've all heard and we've read the narrative of what happened on those days and those nights leading up to Ashura. So I want to skip over that and fast forward to the after Ashura. What happens? How does this message carry on forward? You know, we begin after the day of Ashura. Yes, the tragedy against Abu Abdullah was severe. And even in Ziyat Ashura, we read that one of the lines we say is that was the greatest of tribulations, that was the greatest of calamities which befell all of the inhabitants of heaven and earth. But we know that after that, there was much more that the Ahlul Bayt had to suffer. They had the journey from Karbala to Kufa, and not in the luxury that people travel today. They walked, or they rode saddleless camels. They had challenges walking that distance. And then from there, from Kufa to Sham, and obviously that whole journey will, inshallah, be recounted in the days and nights that we're together. But one of the things that we see is when Lady Zainab alayha salam, when her and the family finally enter into Kufa, a few days after the tragedy of Karbala, one of the very first things that Lady Zainab does, peace be upon her, is to begin to awaken the society of Kufa, of who the Ahlul Bayt are, what happened in Karbala. Now keep in mind that they knew the Ahlul Bayt, because when Amir al-Mu'mineen takes over the caliphate, he immediately moves the seat of government from Medina, where the first three Khulafa had based their government, he moves it to Kufa. So people knew Amir al-Mu'mineen. They knew Imam Hassan and Hussein, peace be upon them. They knew Lady Zainab because she was actually a teacher in Kufa. She would be giving lessons in tafsir of Quran to women while in the city of Kufa. So they knew this family, they knew who they were. But when the historians talk about when they enter into Kufa, what happens? You see the power of Lady Zainab, peace be upon her, in trying to awaken the community who had, under duress, under fear of being taken into prison by Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad and that whole army, that they basically were frightened of supporting the Ahlul Bayt. And so therefore, when Lady Zainab with the Ahlul Bayt, when they walk into Kufa, and the women who are seeing these family being paraded, when they realize who this family is, as Sheikh Abbas al-Kumi mentions in his book, Nafasul Mahmoom, about the event of Karbala, He says that the women who saw Lady Zainab and the women and the children, they began to run and grab their chadors and their cloth and to give it to the women to cover them up, to cover their faces. And Lady Zainab, in that environment, where they've just come out of the tragedy of Karbala, they've had to travel this long distance. She says a very powerful sermon. Obviously, I'm not going to relate the entire sermon tonight. But she severely reprimands the people of Kufa. She tells them, she says that you're sitting here crying. You're crying and lamenting of what you have seen happen to us. She says you need to cry more and laugh less. She says that no matter how much you cry, your tears will never wipe the stains of the sin that you have done by not supporting us, the Ahlul Bayt. And she went on to reprimand them with not in harsh language, but a very harsh tone, showing them that your support of the family of the Prophet, when we needed it the most, it was not there because of the fear of a government of the time who might have done something to them. And so she shows us in her own statement, and as the fourth Imam would later on do in that same gathering, that the people of Kufa, we're not going to say that they were directly to blame because they didn't, you know, move that sword over Imam Hussein's neck. But they had a role to play definitely in turning their back away from Abu Abdullah and the family of the Prophet. Alayhum as-salatu was-salam. Salu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. And obviously this revolutionary spirit of Zainab alayhi salam, it continues eventually when they get to Sham, to Damascus, and she's in the court of the Bani Umayyah. And for those who have been to Damascus, to the Bani Umayyad Mosque, you know what a grand building it is. You know how large it is, how spacious it is. I'm sure you've seen the pulpit where Yazid would have stood as he looked down at the Ahlul Bayt. And if you could imagine a family who have gone through so much difficulty, standing in front of the government of the time, the so-called government, and the speech that she gives in Sham is even more powerful than what she says in Kufa. And she makes it clear to Yazid that whatever you've done, that there is no absolving you of your sin. And she goes on to praise, you know, Allah for the tragedy that they have gone through. And she tells Yazid that no matter what you do, that you could never erase the memory of the Ahlul Bayt from the hearts of the people. And that you can never extinguish this light of Allah, which Allah has lit within the Ummah of Islam. So again, and you read the sermon, you see with what power and with what passion Lady Zainab addresses these individuals, not only Yazid, but all of those people around him, those who had lost their sense of direction of what Islam was, of who Rasulullah was, of who the family of the Prophet was, that these sermons were a wake-up call for those people to realize what they had done to Rasul and Ali Rasul. Alayhum as-salatu was-salam. Salu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. So after Karbala, after Kufa, after Sham, one of the questions that sometimes people ask after this entire tragedy has unfolded, and we've heard about it, and we've listened about it, and we've seen movies made about it, is why do we celebrate, why do we commemorate, rather, this event of Karbala? Why is it not a celebration, as some Muslims say? Why do we commemorate it with sorrow and tragedy? You know, some people tell us, you should celebrate Karbala because it was a victory of truth. People say, well, the shuhada are alive. The Quran says, do not consider those who have been killed in the way of Allah as being dead, that they're alive. And so sometimes people will tell us that you should celebrate this event. It should be a festive occasion. And the twisted logic that they present sometimes gets people to think that maybe they're correct. But obviously we have to realize that when we look at the event of Karbala, as we look at any event in our history, we do so through the lens of not just any scholar, not any companion of the Prophet or the Imams, but rather we look at the event through the lens of the Ahlul Bayt. We see how did the Ahlul Bayt ask us or expect us to commemorate this tragic event. We have a few reasons. Let me just share with us and I'll close very briefly. of why Karbala is so important to us. Why is it for 1,377 years we continue to mark this event? Why do we not just forget about it as people tell us? Why attach so much importance to it in today's day and age? You know, there are so many things happening around the world. You have people in Iraq being massacred, in Syria being killed, in Pakistan, Afghanistan. In so many parts of the world, so many things are happening. People say, why focus on 72 people who were killed? There's so much more tragedy happening around the world. And yes, those tragedies are there. But our scholars give us multiple reasons why Karbala has to remain important. Not just the emotional aspect, the emotions are important, without a doubt. And nobody should ever trivialize crying over Aba Abdullah. But why do we continue to have this event commemorated? Why we march down the streets? Why, as you saw this year, downtown London, England was shut down because of the Who Was Hussein march in the downtown of England, London, a major capital of the world. New York, the same thing. Every major city in the world, the city was brought to a standstill. What was the reason for that? Few things. One is that the movement that Aba Abdullah launched was a movement based on true sincerity for the sake of Allah. He didn't have any ulterior motives. He wasn't looking for power, authority. It wasn't about power struggle. It wasn't about wealth. It was about nothing other than his sincerity to Allah. To defend the message of Rasulullah that the Prophet spent 23 years in bringing and preserving, to preserve the legacy of his father, Amir al-Mu'mineen, to preserve the legacy of his brother, Imam Mujtaba. All of these factors come down to one word, which is ikhlas, the sincerity of Aba Abdullah. Number two is that he is the hujjat of Allah. He is the proof of Allah on the earth. And that in itself is an entire discussion. What does it mean to be the hujjat of Allah? To be the argument of Allah? But that in itself is evident enough, is evidence enough for us to realize why this event trumps and supersedes every other, you know, mass killing, genocide, murder ever taken place in history. Yes, those people were respected, they're ennobled people, but this was the representative of Allah, this was the grandson of Rasulullah, the fifth of the Ahlul Kisa, as we refer to him as. And so him being the representative of God, that takes on even an added significance over all other tragedies that have faced humanity. We also see that his supporters, his companions, compared to all others in the history of the prophetic chain, we can say, they were the most loyal and supportive of followers. When the Quran looks at the companions of Rasulullah, and we know that many of the companions of Rasul, they were great people. We have great people like, you know, Salman, Abu Dharr, Miqdad, Bilal, some of these famous people that we know. And many other, you know, ones which we don't maybe know their names so easily off the tip of our tongue. Many of the companions of Rasulullah were noble people. They gave their life for Rasulullah. They gave their life for Lady Zahra, for Amir al-Mu'mineen. But the Quran still has a chapter called Surah Munafiqun, the chapter of the hypocrites. And Allah tells Rasulullah, around you are people who are habituated to nifaq, to hypocrisy. Allah tells the Prophet, you don't know them, but we know them. And we will punish them a double punishment. So Rasulullah had great companions, but he had people who would leave the battlefield. Battle of Uhud is a clear example. Just study one battle and you'll see how some people were around Rasulullah. But when Sayyidina Shuhada looks at his companions, he says that I don't know any companions who are better than my companions, more loyal, more devoted. And I don't know any other family members who are more devoted to a cause than my family. Again, the Quran is clear. You look at the Quran, some prophets had sons who were disobedient. Nabi Nuh, alayhi salam, his son rejects the message of his father. But look at Karbala. And all of the brave people who were there. Qasim, representing his uncle, his father. You look at Ali Akbar alayhi salam, he doesn't leave his father. Look at Abu al-Fadl Abbas, he doesn't reject his father and why he was there. All of these people, they didn't leave their fathers, as Nabi Nuh's son does. Even the women around Abu Abdullah, his wife, the other ladies of the caravan, the sister, Lady Zainab alayha salam, they didn't leave. They didn't run away from what was going on. Again, the Quran shows us many wives of previous prophets where they came, and Allah says that they were acting with treachery against their prophet. Nabi Lut is a prime example. And so when Imam Hussein says that my companions are the best and my family is the best, he's not exaggerating. He's not giving them, you know, added praise that they don't deserve. They deserve this praise because they stood with him. Even when we were told that he put out the candle at night and said, "You're free to go. I've lifted my allegiance off of your necks. The candle is off. Nobody will know. Nobody will see your face when you leave." But we know that nobody leaves Abu Abdullah. And when the candle is lit, we're told that all of those same companions are there ready to defend and protect Abu Abdullah and the message which he stands for. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. And last but not least, and we'll end with this part for tonight, is that Karbala is commemorated for the last 13 centuries because of all of these points I mentioned, and probably thousands of more. But ultimately, when you look at the narrative and that story of Karbala, that true story, that true narrative of what happened, that all of our scholars have recounted in their books of the tragedy of Karbala, it was not just Hussein alayhi salam against the army. There were so many things that happened before, during, and after Karbala that warrant us to gather year after year after year to remember the tragedy. We remember how the people of Kufa sent 30,000 letters to Imam Hussein, 30,000 people pledging allegiance, or that number thereabouts, and how they then later on change their support for Imam Hussein out of fear. We remember what happened to Muslim ibn Aqil, who is sent as the emissary of Sayyid al-Shuhada to Karbala, and how eventually he is captured in the house of Tawa, how he's taken to the palace of Ibn Ziyad in Kufa, how he is killed, how he's decapitated, and his body is thrown and is paraded and dragged through the streets of Kufa for people to see what would happen when you renegade against the so-called leader of the time. We realize why we commemorate Karbala, how Sayyid al-Shuhada and the family were intercepted in the desert of Karbala, and how they were kept away from the river Euphrates, how water had been cut off to the family, how they were deprived of the life-giving water which even the animals in the plain of Karbala had been given to drink, how even the feet of the horses were cooled with cold water. But yet Abu Abdullah alayhi salam was not given one drip of water, one drink of water on the day of Ashura. We remember Karbala over all of these years because of the complete imbalance in this battle. It wasn't even a battle, although we use that word, but it was 30,000 individuals against an army, a very small army of 72. And if odds are never against you in any other number, then that is the worst of odds to have, is that many people, 30,000 against a small group of 72, mainly defenseless men with their women and children. If we cry for Karbala, and we cry for after 1,300 years, we remember the day of Ashura, and how one after one after one, the Sahaba would go to the battlefield, and they would say that last labbaik to Ya Aba Abdullah. They would proclaim, "Assalamu alaykum Ya Aba Abdullah," before they would fall onto the ground. And Imam Hussein would do his utmost to run towards the battlefield, to put their head on his lap if he could, to see them for that last moment before they leave this world. We remember Karbala for 13 centuries because of what happened to Abu Abdullah after he falls off of his horse, and after he falls not even on the ground, but how he's in the air because of all the arrows that have showered his body, that he's floating on the over the earth. Because of that, we remember Karbala, brothers and sisters. If we remember Karbala over 13 centuries, it's because of the fact that not only was Imam Hussein decapitated, not only was his head put on a spear and paraded from city to city, but his body was trampled over by the horses, so much so that when Imam Zainul Abidin and Bibi Zainab were looking at the day of after Ashura, Imam Zainul Abidin himself says, I could hear every bone in my father's body break as the horses would trample over my father's body. He says, I could hear every rib in his rib cage breaking one after the other. I heard every bone in his body break one after the other. If that wasn't enough, brothers and sisters, 13 centuries of crying of Karbala, it goes back to what we saw that happened to the women and the children, how the ladies were slapped back and forth, how the women, their earrings, the girls' earrings were ripped out of their ears, how they were lit on fire, how all of their possessions had been taken away, even the scarves that they had to cover themselves. If that wasn't enough, brothers and sisters, we remember that Imam Hussein left, his body was left in the plains of Karbala. While the enemy forces were being buried and given a burial, our Mullah was kept on the plains of Karbala without a burial until Imam Zainul Abidin is finally able to give him that burial. And last but not least, and we'll end with this, that if we remember Karbala after 13 centuries, it's not a tradition. This is a tradition from the Ahlul Bayt that we remember what happened to the women and the children after Karbala, being taken from Karbala across the bloodstained fields, having to walk over the body of Imam Hussein, having to go all the way to Kufa, having to travel all the way to Sham, and eventually to make the way back home to Medina. وَسَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيَّ مُنْقَلِبٍ يَنْقَلِبُونَ إِنَّ لِلَّهِ وَإِنَّ إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ. Ya Allah, we ask you as we commemorate, as we continue to commemorate the tragedy of Karbala and the supreme sacrifice of Abu Abdullah, that you accept our acts of worship in this month of Muharram and our acts of worship tonight. Ya Allah, we ask you to give the thawab of this majlis, the thawab of the Surah Yasin, the dua kumail to the souls of all of the deceased from our families, our communities, our friends, the ulama, the shuhada who have left this world. Ya Allah, we ask you to keep us all on the path of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad. We ask you, Ya Allah, as you make the dua in Ziyarat Ashura, that Allahumma jal mahyaya mahya Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad, that Allah, you allow us to live the life of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad, wa mamati mamata Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad, that we leave this world just as Muhammad and Ali Muhammad left this world. Ya Allah, we ask you to keep us all on the path of Islam and Ali Muhammad and our children on the path of Islam. And we ask you to bring a downfall to all of those who are bringing oppression upon this earth and to give all of those who are being oppressed a speedy victory, especially our brothers in Iraq who are fighting against Daesh in Mosul these days. We ask you, Ya Allah, Bihaqi Hussein, Shaheed of Karbala, that you allow our brothers in Iraq to have the freedom that Abu Abdullah alayhi salam had fought for 13 centuries ago. ربنا تقبل منا إنك أنت السميع العليم صلوا على محمد وآل محمد